Investment Management Operations is brought to you by Intelligo. Intelligo is the premier due diligence platform delivering innovative pre-investment background checks and continuous subject monitoring for some of the most sophisticated asset allocators. Their individual and company background check reports blend the critical discernment of human experts with cutting-edge AI, ensuring you receive the most thorough and rapid insights. Groups like Common Fund, Adam Street Partners, Felicitas Global Partners, and past capital allocators guests Hamilton Lane, AIM13, and NEPC leverage Intelligo to mitigate risk and enhance their operational due diligence process. Visit intelligo.ai to learn more. Hello, I'm Ted Seides, and this is Investment Management Operations. This show explores the inner workings of the most sophisticated institutions in the industry. Through conversations with executives across operations, compliance, legal, and finance, you'll hear how key operating partners run their businesses in an ever-changing and complex investment landscape. You can join our mailing list and access Capital Allocators content at capitalallocators.com.
I'm Scott McDonald, and I'm your host. My guest on today's show is Lawrence Miller. Lawrence is the CTO of Wilshire, an independent investment management firm that offers consulting services, analytical products, and manages funds for a global client base. For many of us, owning and understanding technology is critical for our business. However, many of us have come up through the ranks without hands-on training. This is where Lawrence lends a hand. We cover Lawrence's start as a quant at JP Morgan, lessons learned launching a startup, and how his time as a technology consultant landed him the CTO role following a ransomware attack. While these cyber-related issues are often discussed at a high level, one rarely gets into the weeds on actual events. We cover how to respond to a ransomware attack, the current state of disaster recovery, and what makes a good penetration test. We then turn to onboarding a new service provider, better tech-focused due diligence questions for allocators, and why a Python class can help you be a better operational leader or IR person. Please enjoy my conversation with Lawrence Miller. Well, Lawrence, thanks for joining me. I'd love to hear your background and path to Wilshire, and maybe we'll kick it off there.
Thanks for having me on. I have an undergraduate degree in physics, a graduate degree in computer science. I'm what they call all but dissertation. Finished my qualifiers, never wrote my dissertation because I ended up joining JP Morgan in the late 90s. And I was hired into a quantitative role to help build financial models and pricing models. And it was a great experience. Although I was in a quantitative role, a lot of it was technological in nature, working for the front office fixed income trading desks. And it was a really strong engineering organization and I think a great place to learn starting my career out in financial services and in the business world. I was recruited into BlackRock in the early 2000s and became part of BlackRock Solutions to work on Aladdin. I really wanted the opportunity to work in a commercial software organization. As JP Morgan had gotten bigger and bigger, I felt that we were getting farther and farther away from where I started. And there's a difference in building commercial software versus building enterprise technology. When you're building software that's used inside of an organization, your customers are kind of captive. When you are building software commercially as a software and service provider, your customers are not captive. And it brings new meanings for schedules and delivery and projects when they're tied to revenues. At the time, BlackRock was a lot smaller. It had less than 1,000 employees. And I had an opportunity there to grow with the company. We did some really world-class M&A, and it was a great place to learn about that and the best practices in doing mergers. I got to work on the world's two largest asset management mergers back-to-back, Merrill Lynch Investment Management and BGI, and the need for operational excellence in how you execute those types of transactions, not just technically, but also operationally, because I think that these fields are really closely tied together, and you really can't think of one without the other. When you look at changing and rolling out new technology solutions, you need to look at the business processes very closely, and that was something that I've certainly learned in my career was a big emphasis of what I learned at BlackRock. I think something that ties together when you think of operations organizations and technology roles. I then moved to a startup company actually called Symphony, and it was a fintech startup that BlackRock had been involved in creating. And I was actually a board observer at Symphony. And I was feeling the need to get back into a smaller environment. And I viewed this as sort of a unique opportunity. It's hard to go from being a managing director at a big financial services company to a startup. It's risky, but I got my permission slip to join the startup. And in my time at Symphony, I had several roles there, including as the chief security officer of the company. I ran government and regulatory affairs. And that was also a really amazing and very different experience from either of my prior two roles. Symphony, at the time I joined, was a pre-revenue startup. That is a unique experience when you're in a startup company and you're at that stage where you have not gotten to a point of having paying customers yet. And that creates a real focus on speed, getting the first customers, and getting to a point where you're not just spending down your bank account balance every month. It's a really good life experience at some point to work in a startup company and have that experience, because when we work in larger enterprises, we don't have the discipline that a startup company operates under. And to me, that was a very important learning experience in that role. After Symphony, I moved to Signant Health, which is in a different industry from financial services. It's in the pharmaceuticals trials area. That is also a heavily regulated industry. And I actually joined right before COVID-19. And that was an interesting time to be jumping into that space. I had the chance to support several of the major COVID vaccine studies. It was a crazy era to be working on anything back then. I know it was crazy in financial services, but we were looking to get these large trials up and running. And I'm very proud to have had an opportunity to contribute in my little way to that. And then in mid-2022, I moved back into financial services and joined Wilshire as the chief technology officer.
And how did that Wilshire opportunity come about?
It's an interesting story. I had several former colleagues that were working at Wilshire. One Friday morning, I got a call from one of the executives at Wilshire. The company had been subject to a cyber attack. And so I was initially hired as a consultant to help recover from this cyber attack, a ransomware incident, and jumped into that on a Friday. In the morning, I was thinking about having some guests over for dinner and what I was going to cook. And I don't think I ate dinner that night, because I was pulled into recovering from that incident.
And when we say cyber, there's a bunch of different categories. How do you cast that large swath?
You could spend time trying to categorize it. This particular incident was a ransomware attack where you have professional cyber criminals breaking into company networks. And this happens to many companies. It happens to big companies. It happens to small companies. And it can happen to anyone, where you have a professional intrusion into the network. And then the attackers try to do malicious things in order to hold you ransom.
This was already happening. You parachute into the organization. What's the first step for somebody like that to get their arms around?
You don't know anything coming into something like that. I would say that the first step that the company took, even before I had been engaged to help, was an incredibly important step, which is that they immediately shut the systems off. In fact, they had shut off almost all of the systems the company was using. They just shut them down. That is a very conservative thing to do, and it stops the attack cold. It's very important to stabilize the situation and get yourself into a point where you do know what you need to know. And when you don't know, the one thing you can do to stop it, which is to shut things down. And it takes some real courage to do that, because it's disruptive. You're always going to sit there sort of optimistically, maybe this isn't serious, maybe this isn't real. I want to go back to sleep. It's 2 o'clock in the morning. I don't think I'm going to do that. And maybe this will all go away. But that's not how the real world is. So they had very early on shut the systems down, which put them into a mode where the attackers couldn't get any further and where you could start doing forensics and evaluate how you're going to rebuild the infrastructure. The other thing that I think is important in that situation is also that you are open and transparent with your customers and regulators. And so that was also something that Wilshire did very early on, was let the customers know what was happening. You see this all the time in the news with companies that are subject to cyber attacks, and they drag their feet about telling people what happened. That is a terrible strategy. Certainly, using this as an example is an example where honesty and telling customers what happened and bringing them along with you was very important.
Maybe to paint a little backdrop on Wilshire and the implications of, obviously, you're communicating with the regulators, your clients, but what is going on inside? You still need to operate on a day-to-day basis.
And that's where I think starting with communicating with your customers and working with your operations teams, because you need to figure out how to rebuild the infrastructure step by step and do it in a way that has minimum impact on production processes, on customers. A lot of it will have to do with what time of the month did it happen? Do you have certain rebalancing activities that are coming up that need to occur on certain dates? And so a lot of our recovery efforts were very much focused around working with our customers, working with our internal teams to understand impact. And then there's a choice that you have of how you rebuild. And if you're ever presented with this situation, these are the two choices that you're going to have. You can either try to clean your systems of the attacker, try to scrub them out of your systems and remove the attack and attacker from the systems and restore them in place. Or you can do a fresh rebuild from clean backups. Now, the first seems like it's the easiest choice. However, if you do that, how confident are you that the attacker will ever really be out of your systems? And you don't really know how long it's going to take. So the first option is used a lot, but we actually went with the second option, which was, okay, we were already partway migrated to the cloud. So let's take advantage of the fact that we are running cloud infrastructure and rebuild fresh in the cloud. And we'll use our backups, we'll recover the systems, and we will build it on clean infrastructure where we know the attacker isn't present. And so that's the approach that we took. It's harder. You need to be able to rebuild your systems. And if you pull it off successfully, which we did, you then know that you have a clean infrastructure going forward.
Fascinating. What do people often get wrong with this coming out of the gate?
I think the first would be not telling your customers or trying to drag your feet about it. Another thing I think that people make mistakes on is not preserving enough information to do forensics. Once something like this happens, both for your own sanity and your board, your CEO, and your customers, and the regulators are all going to want to know what exactly happened and how do you know it's not going to happen again? And in that regard, you have to have a really solid forensic analysis, piecing back together what happened. And that's never going to be perfect. When attackers, sophisticated attackers, come into systems, they scrub logs and records and they'll try to hide their traces. But there are ways of piecing things back together. And the most important thing you can do is preserve your systems. If you rebuild them in place, you can't do that because you're changing the scene of the accident, if you will. So one of the advantages of the approach we took is that we had a clean forensic snapshot of the systems and could do a very extensive analysis after the incident. One important thing that I would also recommend in responding to this type of incident is not to pay the ransom. We did not pay the ransom that was demanded of us. We rebuilt our systems. But when we talked to customers, regulators, when you're talking to a customer's information security department about something like this, you will get huge props for not having paid the ransom. First of all, it's the right thing to do. You're not feeding the system. And secondly, your customer's information security team will appreciate the fact that you're on the right side of the issue. And it also proves that your backups actually work.
And given the focus of the SEC, they have new cybersecurity rules. Any advice for, obviously transparency is important, but just any other maybe more tangible inputs in thinking about your own infrastructure?
One of the first things that I did after helping out as a consultant and then subsequently being appointed as chief technology officer is that I brought in a new head of information security and we revamped the company's entire policy framework. Policy frameworks is a tremendous amount of advice, not just directly from the SEC, but also from NIST in the cybersecurity framework that NIST publishes. There's been a lot of work in formalizing how all of the different controls that a company implements should work together. There's lots of international standards work in that space. And following industry best practices in that regard is very important because the controls that you need to have are quite broad. Like anything, you want to take a crisis and put it to good use. We did a full rebuild of our cybersecurity policies around industry best practices. I think it's possible over the years as a company's internal policies evolve. And sometimes it's helpful to step back and do a fresh rewrite from scratch because the world has changed enough over a 15 or 20 year period. And I think that's not just true for cybersecurity.
So one question I have is just around how do you operationalize that? So obviously you have standards, you have technologists, you have operations people, and that all has to hang together. What's the collaborative process to get the technology, security, and investment process correct?
At Wilshire, what we do is our chief information security officer actually has a committee of the various operational and business leads, not necessarily the senior-most people, but maybe one level down, who are going to be operating and sort of operational and execution-oriented. And they form a virtual team to help our chief information security officer drive his plans and his priorities forward in terms of improving the company's cybersecurity controls and how we operate and mature how we operate. This is a space that's not static. It's constantly evolving. And that day-to-day sort of detailed interaction of how you follow through with implementing changes and processes that you're trying to roll out, you need to have that like line level interaction and that line level collaboration. When you look at information security governance, part of it is how does it tie to the board? And that's important. But part of it is also how do you tie your information security organization into the departments in a way that will naturally allow them to work together closely.
Tell me more about that board connectivity.
Every board and every board member is going to be thinking about information security as a key risk. I think that's true across the board. And I think in the course of my career, I've often found that the senior-most people in a company, the board, the CEO, are more focused on information security risk than sometimes the middle management is. They're looking at the big picture, and sometimes middle management is looking at, hey, I have to get this project done next week. I'm not going to worry about that. So I think that there does tend to be a gap sometimes between the senior-most executives in organizations who are very concerned and very aware of the potential impact of information security issues and the rank and file, if you will. One of the things that I try to do in how our information security works at Wilshire is make sure that those different levels of the organization are both connected into the CISO.
If you look at your board, who do you need in that space to help be the enabler of thinking about all these things?
My experience has been that, first of all, boards are very consistently aware of it. I think maybe 20 years ago, it was an obscure topic, but it hasn't been an obscure topic for a long time. It's all over the media, and every board member is aware of it and thinking about it. Sometimes some board members are going to be more technical than others, and most company boards, again, in my experience, have somebody on them who is more technical, but you're not typically engaging with the board as subject matter experts. You need to be able to translate the detailed technical things that you're doing into terms that you can talk about at a board level. And that's one of the roles that I would do as a CTO or our chief information security officer would do in interacting with the board. And it's also why you have metrics and KPIs to measure how your programs are performing.
I'd love to hear a little bit more about the organization and then talk about what you guys are doing today.
Wilshire has a long history going back over 50 years. It's a company that's been dedicated to helping investors improve their financial outcomes. And Wilshire does that by creating customized portfolio solutions that are grounded in research and powered by technology. And that technology goes back, has a very long history, but it's also been heavily invested on over the years. We advise over $1 trillion in assets, and we provide investment solutions, advice, and analytics. That includes measuring and controlling risk, asset allocation, researching investment opportunities, and evaluating the best way to implement complex investment strategies. And we do that across the asset class spectrum. So we cover equities, fixed income, but we also work with alternatives. Customers include institutional asset owners like public and corporate pension plans, foundations, endowments, intermediaries like banks, broker-dealers, insurance companies, record keepers, RIAs. And we don't just cover large institutions. We also provide solutions and advice for individuals since we have solutions that are offered through financial intermediaries. And that's backed by portfolio analytics and risk management tools to help clients make well-informed decisions and that tie back to Wilshire's history of analytical innovation that goes back to the 1970s. As you might expect, we leverage technology extensively. Some of that's for large institutional clients, but it's also to meet the needs of individual plan participants. And so that involves investing and building analytical and quantitative capabilities in our systems. And it also involves creating digital distribution technologies that allow us to get our analytical information or our investment recommendations into the hands of the people that need to see them, whether they are institutional clients or individuals.
Are you buying solutions, building solutions? How do you guys tackle the tech stack?
So it's a mix. We do build a substantial amount of technology in-house and have for many years. We also do use off-the-shelf components in particular areas of our business and try to make disciplined decisions about when we're going down one route or the other. Generally, if we think that we have a unique advantage in building something or implementing something that would allow Wilshire to do it better, we'll build something internally. Sometimes we'll also build something internally simply because it's simpler to build it internally. It might be something that isn't unique, but is just easier, and you don't need to worry about integrating a third-party vendor into the mix to do something relatively simple. Sometimes building something yourself, you'll have a simpler solution to just the problem that you're trying to solve. Whereas if you buy a vendor product, it might do way more than you need and is actually hard to simplify how it works. And it may be harder for you to implement in your operational environment. But we absolutely do use vendor products in areas where we feel there are mature vendors and the thing that we're trying to do is fairly complex and better serviced through a vendor product.
And how do you stay on top of the landscape, given the rate of change and adoption and things coming and going?
When you're sitting in the middle of it, you're constantly looking at what your options are. One thing that's important when you're looking at governing a technology organization is keeping your options open and always keeping in mind that you may need to reevaluate your course and not getting yourself too locked into confirmation bias that you've decided a particular strategy is the right one. And so you're going down that path no matter what. Whenever I implement a technology system, I always figure out when I'm deciding to implement it, how I'm going to unimplement it. So you always want to have an exit strategy. If you're bringing in a vendor, how would you get your data out of the vendor? How would you migrate it onto a different system if you needed to? You don't think that you're going to, but guess what? You might be wrong. And eventually, you probably will migrate to a different system. It might be 5 years or 10 years down the road, but you need to think about what your exit strategy is so that you don't get cornered.
And where do people get that wrong?
There are two angles to this. In financial services, market data ownership and data ownership generally is very complicated. And that's probably a subject unto itself. But certainly when you're building solutions, you do need to think about your intellectual property rights to data, to derived data, and make sure that you have the licensing of your data worked out. And it can very much restrict things that you can do down the road. That's also an aspect of the landscape of the world that we live in financial services, and is something that we as technologists or as operations staff, or really anyone working in financial services, need to consider about the solutions that we're building and make sure that we have a commercial path to making that licensing work for us. And it may constrain what we can do. But there's also an aspect when you're building and integrating systems about how the systems tie together, and not specifically about IP rights. But if you're buying a SaaS platform or integrating it into a business process, thinking about how you're going to undo that is sometimes a very good intellectual exercise, because you need to make sure that you can actually export your data off of the system. You need to make sure that you actually have an operational way of changing how your processes work, because you may change your processes down the road.
And what about the security of that organization that you're onboarding?
That's always something you need to look at. And typically, companies have vendor management processes that you go through, because there are going to be a variety of considerations when you're bringing on a vendor. In addition to doing legal and contract review, you want to look at the information security controls of the vendor as early as possible. Sometimes vendors will have third-party audit reports that you can look at. Sometimes they won't. And you need to look at how a system is being used, what kind of data is going on the system, and what's your confidence in the vendor's ability to secure your data, which is going to depend on what data you're putting there, how mature the vendor's controls are, and doing an assessment. And that's typically something that your information security team will help with. The best thing you can do to help your information security team is to involve the technology teams as early as possible in the vendor evaluation process.
And then how much is your team involved with the service level agreement, and how does that work? Is it a legal issue, tech issue? Curious your insight on that.
I would look at it as a tech and operations issue. Fundamentally, SLAs are an operational issue at their core, but technically, when it comes to actually responding to incidents, your information technology team very likely will be interacting directly with the vendor. And our ability to meet SLAs in the technology teams is going to depend on how we interact with the vendor and how quickly they respond. So if at the end of the day, I'm being asked to maintain a business process at a particular surface level, the vendors that I'm dependent on factor into my ability to hit the SLAs, to do disaster recovery, to do a whole variety of things that I need to do to support the business.
And on disaster recovery, we are now living in an environment where many people are living as if it's a disaster because no one's in the same place quite often. What's the current state of play on disaster recovery?
It's fascinating. In a lot of cases, people have not rewritten their disaster recovery policies and procedures to take into account, A, the changes of how we work post-COVID, where most people are working remotely, many companies, and they also haven't been rewritten to take into account the cloud. And as companies use the cloud more and more, your risk profile of different types of disasters changes. And at Wilshire, we've done extensive rewrites to our business continuity policies and procedures, taking into account both of those changes. But I certainly do see, when I look at business recovery processes of other companies at some points, policies that very much look like they're still 2005 era policies. They're expecting everything to run in a data center. They change over to their alternate data center. They're dependent on the employees being in a physical office. That was certainly true 20 years ago, and it was probably even true 10 years ago, but it's not true in many companies today.
If I'm an allocator and I'm looking at giving money to an organization, is there any top level questions that somebody can get to that will maybe surface of how well they have their hands around the issue of cyber?
The best thing that you can look at is to have a detailed look at the company's policy documents, but also a discussion with their team to see how they're approaching the topic. If you're getting superficial answers to the questions, I would dig deeper because you want to have somebody that's actually being thoughtful about it. If somebody tells you that they are not worried about a cyber attack, I would worry about that. You want organizations to be constantly looking in and worrying about risks and constantly be evolving and changing their programs. And so I think that's probably at the core of determining whether an organization has a really robust program is how seriously they're taking it. And it's not an area where there are simple, easy answers to it. Every organization can have a cyber attack, and many organizations have had cyber attacks. The question is, how ready are they when those things happen, and how effectively are they going to be at responding to them when they occur?
Is there anything changing with the legislative piece of it that's giving a sense of maybe the stuff is happening more often than we realize it, and so we don't appreciate the risk profile that it has?
I think that the transparency issue is a real problem, and a lot of the regulatory movement in the space is to encourage companies to be more transparent. Now, I think that independent of regulation, it's better customer service. If you're going to have a good relationship with your customers, you want to be transparent. To me, there's a value to doing that independent of the regulation, but I don't think that all companies have held up that value in the same way. And so it's not surprising that you see regulatory movement to require more disclosure, and whether it's customers or individuals or public markets, if you're a publicly traded company and you're looking at some of those new SEC regulations. So across the board, I think there is a real need to do that. But I would also like to encourage people, independent of those regulations, that it's just the right thing to do to come clean with your customers. And your customers will know eventually it's going to come out. And if you told them the day it happened, it's very different than if you told them 3 or 4 months later.
On the smaller end of the spectrum, you've got a lot of organizations who, at the top level, are thinking about pen testing, phishing. Any advice for organizations that are smaller in scale? What do you worry about that maybe people overlook?
Phishing testing is a great example. One of the biggest risks that companies have is the people in the company. There's a huge amount of attacks using a technique called social engineering, where an attacker will pose as another person inside of the company, as an executive, send you a malicious link, and use that to breach into your systems. This is happening constantly, and your company's awareness of the staff is incredibly important in terms of preventing those types of attacks. And phishing training, constantly sending out test emails that look really realistic, and having an information security team that's willing to make some tricky fake emails through some of these testing programs that you can run is really important in terms of keeping employee awareness up. It's not a technology or information security specific task. It's something that everybody in the company needs to participate in and take seriously. And we all know this is happening to us constantly, but at the end of the day, organizations are driven by people and the technology only is going to take you so far. And attackers are constantly figuring out how to get past your spam filters and come up with more and more complex notes. When there are data breaches, customers can have very detailed and realistic looking information about other financial institutions and can send you very realistic looking attacks. Your employees' awareness is incredibly important. And so that type of testing is something companies really need to do constantly and take very seriously. The other example that you raised was penetration testing, which is hiring ethical hackers to try to break into your systems. That's very important. But when I look at pen tests, I typically look at two things. The test results aren't the key thing to me. The big questions are, first, how extensive of a test was it? You can hire vendors to do very superficial tests, to run through standardized testing scripts, and that'll tell you something. But there are more sophisticated vendors that you can hire who will do more complex attacks. Are they testing you just from the outside? Or are you also giving the testers internal access into your networks to see if they can find ways around, even if somebody's already in the network? And there's a concept called defense in depth in security. When I run tests, you do an external test, then you give them access to the internal network and you see what they can find. Because at some point, somebody may go from outside inside. And you don't want it to be like an egg where it's hard and crunchy on the outside and soft and gooey on the inside. You need to have layers. So you have to have a very comprehensive test and you need to hire a vendor that really can do a sophisticated test. And then the other thing is that the purpose of a pen test isn't to find all of the problems that you have. The purpose of a pen test is to see how effective your security program is. The testers will find something, but they should find things that aren't critical. When I look at the test results, what I would typically be looking for is how effective was the overall control program, not what exactly did these results say. Because a company could go fix everything that's on that report and 12 months later find out that there's a whole bunch of other things that are issues because they don't have an effective overall control program. So I view it as a way of measuring the effectiveness of the controls.
And what about budgets? With unlimited time and money, I can do a lot of things, but how do you think about budgeting for tech, given the fact that you can't cover off every single possible risk?
So the way I would look at budgeting around information security programs is that it really needs to be tied into the overall work that you're doing in your technology programs. You absolutely will have a certain amount of independent budget for information security, and there's certain things that you need to spend money on. They may be information security control software, end user device control software, but that's actually not the largest spend. In my view, the largest spend is actually the time that you're taking from all of the rest of your engineering teams to make continual improvements to your systems. If you spend X dollars on a penetration test with a vendor, it's going to cost you 5X to fix everything that the vendor comes up with. So the real investment there isn't the budget for the pen test. It's budgeting enough time from all of the rest of the teams to allow them to fix problems or frankly, just to make continuous improvements and build things right. I would view this across the organization. And it's a question to me fundamentally of priority. It's not just true for information security. It's true for, are you building buggy software? Do you have good DR capabilities? It's faster to build a system without building strong recovery capabilities into it. And it looks like you did a great job of building the system as quickly as possible for as little money as you could until a disaster happens.
Talking about team and staff, how do you look at hiring people in information technology?
There are a variety of different types of people and personalities that you need in technology teams. Some of the best programmers I've worked with don't have computer science degrees. Some of the best programmers that I've worked with do. And I think that when I look at hiring people in line level programming jobs, I want to see them write code. I want to see what the quality of the code is that they're writing. One of my favorite interview techniques is to ask them to program something that's impossible to write in computer code and to see how they react to it. Because when you are doing work in a professional environment, you are going to run into sometimes requests that don't make sense. And engineers sometimes have trouble processing those types of questions. So seeing how people react to very challenging coding problems, how they handle adversity and running into barriers, or how they tell you that you're wrong.
And what's an example of that? What's an uncodable challenge?
My favorite way of doing it is asking them to write a computer function, but specifying the way the computer function works with an error in it. And so it forces them eventually to see that what I ask them to do isn't actually possible, and they need to tell me there's an error in my specification. And I'm looking for somebody that's going to tell me I'm wrong. It's a good trick question. And any company, you want people that are going to challenge you as a leader, not inappropriately, but when you make a mistake, you want people to tell you that.
So having this engineering flexibility, as we talk about it, tell me more about how you have nimble engineers.
One of the best techniques that I've used for this and that I've learned over the course of my career is moving people around from project to project. You want people to be comfortable working on a different system or a different technology, different programming language. I think I once worked out that I've programmed in something like 17 different programming languages in the course of my career. You want engineers that are not just going to say, hey, I'm a Java programmer or I'm a .NET programmer, and I'm not going to program anything other than that. You want people that can move from one technology to another, from one project to another. You want engineers who are familiar with different systems and how they work. You want diversity of thought on how platforms are built and architected. That is important partially just because having a fresh perspective or a different idea or some new person in the team is valuable. But it's also valuable when you decide that the organization needs to prioritize work in a particular area and you want to shift resources around and surge people onto a particular project that you've decided has to get done and is really urgent. So you really get two benefits out of mobility in engineering organization. One of them has to do with cross-training and cross-pollinating ideas. And the other is that it gives you a flexibility in making things happen fast when you need to.
We touched upon how to keep the steady state. But I think the more important part here is think about innovation. So we as allocators, investors, we're always trying to think about how to find alpha, how to deliver services. How does you as a technologist think about making business impact in a meaningful way?
There are two ways, I think, foundationally, that we can make impact as technologists in systems. Some of it comes from developing systems that do something novel or new. A lot of times when we talk about innovation, it's a new algorithm or a new technology or introducing artificial intelligence into the equation, a new numerical algorithm, a better underlying risk model or something like that. And that is a very important part of innovation. But another part of innovation, in my view, is just operational excellence and being able to operationalize technology and make it work really consistently and help support your operational processes consistently. And in the investment space, I think both of these things are very important, that raw innovation of a novel idea, but also the value that you get from being able to scale up a process or reduce errors in a process to engineer a better business process by rethinking it. And I think a lot of times we don't think of that as innovation, but it really is.
If you even look at private markets, it's still fundamentally a paper process, but compared to public markets, which you go on and I'm just going to buy this ticker and we're done. But then I go to buy private equity and it's a 30-step process with 20 people involved. We're in this interesting time when things are starting to actually digitize and get a little bit closer to public markets. And then I have to ask about trends, AI. Can you help demystify some of this?
AI is a fascinating example because I think there has been a lot of mystification that's gone on with AI. And don't get me wrong, I think AI is very important technological development. It's very exciting. It's something that is going to have a very big impact on how markets work, how companies work, how we all work. However, it's also been something that's been built up. Look at the Silicon Valley hype machine as this incredibly powerful, all-seeing, all-thinking machines, Terminator movie. And that makes it sound mysterious. It makes it hard for people to look at the innovations that are happening in this space and actually figure out how to use them because you're just standing back and saying, oh my, that's really complicated and fancy sounding. And so I can't engage with this topic. Whereas I think that the most exciting thing about AI to me is the incredibly democratic aspect of how you can interact with AI, large language models, and the way that you interact with technologies like ChatGPT is in English. And so unlike some of the technological innovation that was happening earlier with machine learning, where you needed to have machine learning specialists who needed to have all sorts of advanced degrees in order to build the underlying models, the amazing thing with these pre-trained models that are used with the large language models that are coming into the market now is that anyone can program them because you prompt them in English. That's what you type into ChatGPT. And that's actually how all ChatGPT prompting works, even behind the scenes. Not the underlying trainings of those models is something a little different, but the actual way that you prompt the models is in English. And so this is something that anyone in business space can engage with and use directly. It's not just the domain of technological acolytes with some complex artificial brain. It's explaining to something that interacts with the English language. And so a lot of the training that I've been doing for teams inside of Wilshire has really been around stripping out some of that mystique, saying, here's how the algorithms actually work, giving a fairly technical explanation of them, and then getting into how do you engineer prompts? And it's just writing English. But there are techniques that work better or worse. And as we learn how to use those techniques, we're going to be able to get amazing things out of those models. But it's a democratic technology that everyone can interact with. If you think about Microsoft Excel and spreadsheets, one of the amazing things about that transformed financial services probably from the 1980s into the early 2000s was the development of the spreadsheet. And what makes spreadsheets amazing is not the mystique of how the computer works with them, it's that everyone can build spreadsheets. And that unlocked all sorts of innovation across the financial services industry. And I think that if we engage with artificial intelligence the same way, hey, it's a tool, it's like a spreadsheet, let's learn how to use it, we can do amazing things.
Do you look at trying to find outside providers to help you with that, or is that totally insourced?
We're focusing on that internally. I think that it's a very new and rapidly evolving area. I think that it makes a lot of sense to get the model from outside, right? The underlying large language model, you're probably not going to train that on your own. Unless you're a really gigantic financial institution, you're going to rely on a model that's been developed by a third-party company. But I would view it like, are you going to bring in Microsoft Excel consultants, or are you going to learn how to use Excel?
Yeah. Good point. Lawrence, this has been really helpful, insightful. I learned a bunch of things. One of the things we'd like to leave with is two closing questions. One would be, what advice would you give to an emerging manager from a technology perspective?
Don't be afraid of technology. One of the non-technology managers that I worked with for many years was starting to take more and more senior roles and had to take on some teams that did have programmers in them. And one of the first pieces of advice that I gave him was to go take a programming class and learn a programming language, which is not something that this person had ever done, not something that we really needed to do on a day-to-day basis, but it allowed him to understand and interact with the developers in the team and meant that they weren't working in some foreign language that he didn't understand. You need to be able to ask questions. You need to be able to push back and interact with technology. And so getting your hands dirty with it a little bit, I think helps. And I think we shouldn't be afraid of it.
And then the other question we like to ask is, what industry resource that you suggest people or recommend to people?
I would say, and I'm going to give a very meta answer to that, is read the documentation. Whether it's something technical, whether it's a regulatory topic, the resource I would refer to is the original material. I think a lot of times I hear about people talking about regulatory topics and they didn't read the actual regulation. The regulations are written by smart people who are thoughtful about what they write, and they put a lot of thought into writing up the regulation, and then you get somebody to interpret it, write a memo, and then you read this interpretational memo. There's value to the interpretation, don't get me wrong, but I think that you also need to engage with the source material. And I think that we shouldn't be afraid of digging into source material and reading it. So when I think of industry resources, the first thing I always do is to go to the original source, whether it's a technical document, whether it's how a computer system works, or whether it's a regulatory topic or any other financial topic, read the original material.
That's really insightful. And people are struggling. They don't have a lot of time. So why don't I just take the executive summary that somebody else that I believe is smart to dig in and tell me what it says. It's a great takeaway.
We love looking at these news articles or YouTube video, but you're getting it through a filter. And it matters what these things say. I've had direct conversations with regulators where I'll come out of some discussion or meeting with the regulatory department of a financial institution, and they'll have had a particular interpretation of the regulation. And then I'll go talk to the regulator and say, this is this interpretation that I heard, and I won't name the financial institution. Is that right? And they'll say, that's not what I meant when I wrote that. We rely too much on interpretations, and it tends to cloud the original source material, which has usually had a lot of thought put into it.
Great. Thanks for the time and appreciate all the insight. And let's stay in touch.
Thank you for having me on.
Thanks for listening to the show. If you like what you heard, hop on our website at capitalallocators.com, where you can access past shows, join our mailing list, and sign up for premium content. Have a good one, and see you next time.